This is Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. And then there were two. Remember that crowded Republican debate stage not so long ago? All those candidates competing for the right to be the alternative to the guy conspicuously missing. Well, the final debate before voting and caucusing actually starts is next week in Des Moines, Iowa, and it is just going to be two people, Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis. And really, the clock is running out, right? We're officially in an election year now. Voters in Iowa, New Hampshire are going to be voting or caucusing, and Donald Trump's lead in the polls is still robust, which makes you wonder if this whole primary process was less a competition and more of a coronation. Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy are both here, as always. Happy New Year to you both.
Happy New Year.
Happy most arbitrary thing that we do in human civilization.
Celebrate New Year? Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we
thought we were doing, I thought we'd do rants at the end of the show.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That's your rant.
Coming in hot.
Rant
in 2024,
away.
Y'all.
Well, come in hot and talk politics because Sarah, you've been here before on the inside of Republican presidential campaigns. You know this moment. If you're inside the Haley campaign or the DeSantis campaign, are you really thinking you have a legitimate shot, or are you just going through motions now?
Okay, so let's put this into a few buckets. One, there's the backward-looking things you could have done differently for the last year that would have made a marked difference at this point in the race.
Oh, like when DeSantis was like in the 30s and actually looked like he had a shot?
Yeah,
now he's, treading
and
water?
And had, you know, just begillions of dollars that have been spent to lose altitude.
Squandered.
So I think that's an interesting conversation. That's probably a conversation worth having after this is all said and done, which will be in short order. So what I actually hear you asking is, what can be done between now and 2 weeks from now, where the Iowa caucuses will be done and then New Hampshire less than 3 weeks from now, that could actually make a difference in this race?
Yeah.
I mean, miracles do happen, but short of that, you know, ground games matter, turnout matters. Trump has low propensity voters. So when you're looking at a state like Iowa with the caucuses, you got to really want to participate in caucuses. Mo, I'm sure we'll talk about this as well, but it's a funny little national sport we have, the Iowa caucuses.
Yeah, but you have jobs, you have like families to make dinner
life,
for and to go spend like five hours in a town hall in the evening. It's a lot.
And it's cold.
Yeah,
Don't forget the cold. And then when you get to New Hampshire also, the low propensity part matters because you've got, and we've talked about this before, all these independents who are now probably going to go vote in the Republican primary if they bother to turn out, if they think it's a real competitive race. And yes, I think they are more likely to vote for Nikki Haley. But that's a double-edged sword then for Nikki Haley. If she wins the New Hampshire primary, she's going to get attacked for, and bear with me here, for being too palatable in a general election. You know, how dare she? I mean, if she wins New Hampshire, it'll be because she got all of these independent voters who would never vote for Donald Trump. And that will somehow be a bad thing. Just wait. It will be. And then you head into South Carolina. And really, my larger point would be heading into Super Tuesday, which is far more of a national election. You can't do retail politics across that many states for Super Tuesday. I just don't see how, even if the miracles happen in Iowa and New Hampshire, Trump doesn't have that firewall coming up pretty quickly thereafter.
Mo, I'm curious what you think of a lot of what Sarah said, but in particular, like, you know, the assumption that if she attracts Haley independent voters in New Hampshire, that Republicans like in South Carolina are just going to be like, oh my God, I don't want someone who, you know, is sort of middle of the road and attracting centrist voters. I mean, that's kind of a bummer, but is that the reality you see?
I don't know. I mean, Republicans want to win.
What evidence do you have from the last three cycles that Republicans want to win?
The problem is they think they can with a guy who has proven in three straight elections that he can't win. But, you know, if Nikki Haley's able to win all these independent voters in New Hampshire and shock the world by beating Donald Trump, it might strengthen her electability argument. But I think it's tough. I think the Republican calendar gets harder and harder the more they move on. I don't get this Iowa caucus campaign start to finish. These guys all say that they want to beat Donald Trump. None of them have gone after Donald Trump until just the last week or so.
And still not even that much. I mean, they're not going after him
that
much.
And not even then. And they're going after him while at the same time continuing to defend him when, when he gets kicked off a ballot in another state or whatever. They're just
that's
not running.
This is the 2028 primary. It's not the 2024 Republican primary.
And that's
primary.
The thing, right? I mean, Haley and DeSantis, I think, are running for 2028. If you want to take them at their word that they're running to win now, then okay, Iowa is a race for second place, but for very different reasons. DeSantis needs to come in second place because he was always supposed to be the guy, the alternative, and his campaign has all but collapsed. So if he comes in third place, he is done. If Haley gets second place, she's defied some expectations. And then she can ride a little wave of momentum into New Hampshire, a state that she's already supposed to do relatively well in. So, you know, they're running for second place for different reasons. But I think Sarah's point is right. There isn't a lot. There has to be some sort of radical change in the dynamics of this race for anyone not named Donald Trump to be the Republican nominee. A smart campaign can create some of those conditions. None of these campaigns have done anything to change the conditions.
But let's talk about a smart campaign could change the conditions. Like, Sarah, I want to stay on your point a little bit about if, you know, say Haley does well in New Hampshire. Like, couldn't a smart Haley campaign try somehow to drive a message home? Like, you do not want a race between these two old white men named Donald Trump and Joe Biden. You want something new. I'm the answer. Is there a way to articulate that message without falling into the trap of being attacked by other Republicans who are calling her just a Democrat in disguise?
She's tried that. Look, to her credit, we can rag on all these campaigns, but there's something really important to understand about campaign strategy. Sometimes you can execute a very smart strategy very well, and it still won't mean that you win.
We could sit here saying, God, that was really smart and voters don't care. I mean, they're going to do what they want to do.
That's right. And like, or that the delta is just too great, or the, you know, I always compare this to curling, right? You've got this really heavy stone going down the ice. All the campaign can do is sit there with the broom sweeping very furiously at the ice. And yes, it can make a difference and things can turn or move a little. But at the end of the day, you've got a 40-pound rock going down ice. There's only so much you can do with a broom and furious sweeping. So I think that the Haley campaign will, if they won in New Hampshire, I think they would get swamped by a few different waves. One, it would be the Trump campaign saying that she stole it, and at the same time saying that it's proof that she's part of the establishment. Because what's happening in both political parties, right, is that winning actually proves that you're not pure. And so that's, I was saying it tongue in cheek, like, why does Mo think Republicans want to win? But it could be said of both parties. Somehow winning is what proves that you're not real. Haley, by winning New Hampshire, by getting independence, which 30 years ago would have been like, wow, she really proved that she's, you know, forced to be reckoned with in the general election, will actually be very hard for her to overcome heading into some of these other states. Because the hit will be that she did that by, you know, compromising, not fighting for us. I'm putting all of those in scare quotes. As I said, this the whole time has been the 2028 Republican primary. There was never any reason to go hard at Donald Trump in a 2028 Republican primary. And so you can answer almost all your questions by saying, yeah, but what would it look like if it were 2028?
Well, and that's really important because I have to admit something slightly embarrassing. Like I had to look up to confirm that indeed under constitutional law, Donald Trump can only run for one term, which sets this up in this rare predicament, right? Can only serve one more term.
That could potentially be pretty important in 2028 if he loses. Because he could run again in 2028.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Stop it.
He could
win
2028.
Yes, if Biden wins in re-election, Donald Trump could run again. But let's just say in this scenario, like, he cannot run for re-election if he wins.
Correct.
Which is a weird thing. Being a president from the party on the outside, trying to take the White House back for Republicans, but if he gets
for
in,
only 4 years.
Can only serve 4 years. So as you're saying, I mean, if DeSantis or Nikki Haley, let's say, are Trump's vice president, their run for president begins on Inauguration Day, right?
Yeah. I mean, if this was a race for Trump's running mate, they should all concede to Vivek Ramaswamy because he's been, that's the campaign he's been running. I don't think either of them are doing that. Look, we've got just a short period of time before the Iowa caucus and then New Hampshire right after that. This is when we will see how serious Nikki Haley is about whether or not she actually wants to defeat Donald Trump. And this week she got the perfect issue handed to her. Right. She has tried to be the China hawk on the Republican debate stage. Well, you know, late this week, a report came out that showed that Donald Trump's businesses received $7.6 million from $7.8 million from foreign governments.
Yeah.
While he was president. And most of that, $5.6 million of it, came from China. She has been relentless in going after Vivek Ramaswamy for his ties to China, his business ties to China. She's gone after Ron DeSantis for being soft on China.
So here's her moment.
This story is just, this is a being handed to her on a silver platter as an opportunity to draw a real distinction to go after Donald Trump. If she does not do it with the ferocity she has shown Ramaswamy and DeSantis on this, then she's not serious about actually trying to make a play this year.
Well, not only not serious to me, I agree with you, but also if I'm a voter in Iowa or New Hampshire, and I am sitting here thinking, you know, do I want Trump or do I want an alternative? To seriously consider an alternative, I would want to see someone who is fighting Trump and telling me why I don't want Trump.
But David, we ran that experiment. That experiment is called Chris Christie. He's so unpopular in the Republican
Party,
and he's
Haley,
doing all the things.
Haley could do it better than Christie. I think Haley could deliver that message better than Chris Christie.
Fair enough. Here would be my strategy for the Haley campaign. And again, I think they are doing parts of this. I think I would be a little more singular about it, but I've been there, and that's not always an option when you're sitting in these town halls and you're answering all these questions. But it's actually something you've already said, David, which is Donald Trump can only serve one term, and Nikki Haley is, at least right now, beating Joe Biden by more than Donald Trump. This is an electability issue. Republicans, if you want to take back the White House, I've got a better shot than Donald Trump. I get it. All of us can beat Joe Biden. But things can change between now and Election Day. So let's take the fastest horse, not just the horse that happens to be the slowest horse. So let's take the fastest horse to the finish line and one that can serve 8 years. And that's a way to pull off those voters without having to basically attack their own choices. Because the more you say Donald Trump's a bad guy, the more you're saying your vote in 2020 was for a bad guy. Your vote in 2016 was for a bad guy. And they don't believe that.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Mo and Sarah and I will be back. We're going to talk about, we're going to do a deep dive into political parties in the United States here in 2024, here on Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
All right, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green, the co-founder of Fearless Media and your host. We have Moa Lathy, who was communications director for the DNC and now leads Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, and Sarah Isger, a lawyer who was spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump, and she is now senior editor at The Dispatch. You know, we are in a presidential election year. As we've said, there's going to be a Republican nominee and a Democratic nominee. Maps with states turning red or blue that we'll be seeing countless times. But, you know, one question, and Sarah, you brought this up as we were kind of chatting before the show this week. You know, does this binary framing really represent the country we are today? And how do political parties operate in today's climate? It's been a little while, but Pew Research did this survey in 2021 and found such a diversity of views within the two parties. They found that a more accurate way to look at our country would be to divide people into something like 9 groups, with 4 on the left and 4 on the right, and what they call stressed sideliners in the middle. And I love the term stressed sideliners. But this kind of came up in, you know, as we were talking in the before the break, you know, thinking about people in parties like who fights for us, candidates wanting to portray themselves as fighting for us. But, you know, it raises the question, who is us? And there are a lot of different different sort of categories of that. Mo, let me start with you. I mean, can you speak to the sort of classical divisions that you're used to seeing in our country in the parties, if that even term applies, and what changes or shifts that we've seen leading into this moment?
I mean, and we've talked about this a little bit on the show before, but if you go back to the beginning of the Republic, there's been one central question that has really dominated our politics, and the divide on that question has represented sort of our political parties. And that question was, what is the appropriate size and scope of government? But I don't think that today is that fundamental question that is dividing us anymore. I think we are living in an era where people aren't thinking about politics in terms of government. They're thinking about politics in terms of all institutions. And so our political dialogue and discourse has shifted to sort of the institutionalists versus the non-institutionalists. That's sort of becoming the fundamental question, right? The front versus the back, as opposed to the left versus right. People who feel like institutions aren't serving them, they're not helping them, and we kind of need to either reform them or even blow them up. And those two arguments can be made on both the old political left and the old political right. You have conservatives who believe in the strength of the institutions, and you have those who want to blow them all up. You have the same can be said about progressives. It's why the Tea Party and the Occupy movement were ascendant at the same time. It's why Trump and Bernie Sanders back in 2016 were both doing well around the same time. And so it's just changed the whole paradigm of what is motivating and driving our politics. It's created interesting coalitions amongst the electorate, not in necessarily in governing, because honestly, those who are governing are, I think, the last to recognize this. But in terms of the coalitions of voters that are being assembled to support certain candidates, you know, there's something going on out there when you see Donald Trump's able to turn out working class, disaffected working class white voters from rural America while increasing his vote share among some Hispanic voters, right? There's a fundamental realignment going on, and the political party structure doesn't work as cleanly on this divide as it did on the old one.
Well, those coalitions you're talking about, I mean, to your point, it comes down less to R versus D and more to, do I believe institutions are hearing me, listening to me, representing me? And if not, you know, am I open to someone saying, like, let's rip the foundation down? I hear you, and I will fight for you if institutions won't. But when you know, it's interesting, Mo, when you say it's not, parties can't operate as cleanly. Sarah, you said something super interesting. I mean, you said that if parties aren't made up of a single coherent principle and all the policy issues that follow, instead, they're a hodgepodge of sometimes contradictory ideas, which is in some ways is their greatest strength. I would have thought you would say that all these contradictory ideas might actually weaken parties and be a weakness, but you're saying the opposite.
It's both, right? It's going to be their greatest strength and their greatest weakness. So we're seeing the weakness in some ways right now, for instance, in the Democratic Party, where you've got these fractures over things like, Israel and Palestinians, for instance. That is a weakness right now in the Democratic Party because there is not some overarching priority that pulls all them together that's more important. So that's where you're going to see the weaknesses play out again and again. But there's a reason that that's a strength too, because it doesn't matter whether they all have to agree forever and ever on this single priority, because as we've said on this podcast, for instance, so you don't like the way Joe Biden has handled the Israeli war? Who are you going to vote for, Donald Trump? No, of course not, because you've got all these other reasons that you're still belonging to the Democratic Party. And so one example, I'll use an example from sort of both parties, but right, you have the pro-life party also being the pro-death penalty party. And spare me all the tweets and emails I'm about to get. Yes, I understand the arguments for why those are not contradictory, but it's odd, nevertheless, to have them in the same political party. On the Democratic side, I'll give a more interesting example that I think better highlights the problem, because there are so many young people who are progressives who say that by far their number one priority is climate change. And it's not a hodgepodge for them. They would like to have a singular focus on climate change. But if your singular focus is climate change and you've studied history, I would think you'd be getting really frustrated by continuing to focus on government action, which is obviously not working, but not going to work either if you look through history. I mean, world hunger was largely changed by Norman Borlaug, right? It was private energy creation, invention, discovery. And yet within the Democratic Party, it's also anti-nuclear. It's focused on government fixes when in fact, like, even if you fix the United States government on climate change or Western Europe, China and India are your problems, man. This isn't going to change anything. So you should be putting all of your energy into those inventions and that sort of creative energy. But that's not what's happening at higher ed universities. And that's not the pressure that they're getting from the left. So again, like, that's the sort of internal contradiction that I see in the parties that I find fascinating.
The climate change. Wow. That it's so interesting, because I think it comes down to trust, right? Like a lot of progressives and people who say climate change is their number one issue, they trust the government to take action in a way that they would not trust the private sector, who, you know, probably they believe are just out for profits and not to make the world a better place. I'm not saying I agree with this, because you're bringing up some stuff to really that's interesting to chew on, but it really does go back.
I totally agree that they trust the government, but the government cannot fix their problem. It's not a trusting the government to want to. It's whether the government is capable of doing so. And it's not whether you like private sector's motives. Is that the private sector actually will have the ability to solve climate change potentially. I mean, same. You don't have to like Norman Borlaug, trust Norman Borlaug. You don't have to have any thoughts on Norman Borlaug. You don't have to know who he is.
I mean, we're going a little adrift from the topic, but there's a difference between innovation and other ways to look at it. And I'll give an example. Sure, we want the private sector involved, right? And that's one of the reasons why I think so many progressives support investing in clean technology, right? They're not putting it all into the government. They want to invest it in those corporations that are innovating on clean energy and clean technology. It doesn't mean everyone's going to support all and trust all these energy companies. Another great example of that, I think everybody gives the pharmaceutical companies a ton of credit for being able to come up with a COVID vaccine so quickly. But it took a lot of government partnership, and it's one of the few things Democrats will actually give the Trump administration some credit for. It took a lot of government partnership with the pharmaceutical companies in order to get it done. But if you were to poll people on what industry they trust the least, my guess is pharmaceutical companies will be amongst the bottom rating. Why? Because of how they handle the cost of prescription medication. So there's lots of reasons why people trust and don't trust institutions. I guess the old political left, which still exists, argues that there is a role for government to invest in and support certain energies, certain technologies, and to partner with the private sector. Whereas the old political right would say, actually, government shouldn't play much of a role in this at all. It should all be market driven. It should all be corporate driven. But that's not where a lot of people's heads are today. That's not what they're thinking about. There's really no institutions out there that people trust. They believe that the system is just rigged against them. And so it puts both parties in a challenging place to try to figure out how to put what's the hodgepodge of issues that we want. I think that's one of the reasons why the Republican Party in 2020 just almost gave up on this whole exercise, said we're not even going to have a party platform. And as a result, it's further eroding and weakening the parties and creates more opportunity for and more challenges for there to be other mechanisms for people to sort of grasp on two.
But what does that mean? What can I ask you, like, let me ask you both about it. Like, when you talk about other mechanisms, I mean, I do think about an issue like abortion, where polls show that the majority of Americans are not in a place where it's like, you know, they want absolute access to every kind of procedure at any point in pregnancy, or they want to ban abortions completely. I mean, there's a very open-minded middle, despite very strong views on a woman's right to choose, despite very strong views on, you know, religion and life. But like, how do we get to a place where we're still in a two-party system, but people who have those nuanced views on abortion feel represented, feel a political identity, feel like they have, you know, choices that aren't awful when it comes to elections? Like, what about them?
Yeah, I mean, welcome to a two-party system. That's not how it works. And to Mo's point about the parties becoming weaker and weaker, and again, I can trace that pretty easily back to campaign finance reform in 2002. Political parties are what tried to make a narrative out of the hodgepodge. You know, well, we're the party for opportunity for all. We're the party for, you know, progress, whatever. As the parties fail to sort of have any carrots or sticks for candidates, personalities drive stuff. The candidates can create their own conglomeration of issues that try to maximize their chance of success. But what you're finding is that because of small dollar donors now sort of running the world, the political candidate world, I mean, they're not, small dollar donors are not interested in that middle ground, and that they are far more likely to be on the extremes.
I mean, what makes me kind of sad is I think that we're going to be in a presidential election year where it's going to be all about Trump doing his thing and saying, I will fight for you. And the institutions are against all of us, including him. And you're going to hear Joe Biden saying another Trump presidency is dangerous as hell. It's unthinkable. And so we can't have it. And that's the framing. That's basically the choice in many ways facing voters. And it, I wish our two-party system could have created and could create a space for a more interesting, substantive debate about the future of our country. But maybe that's...
I think you are living under... I think you've got a bit of a romanticized view of a multi-party system and how that could solve this challenge.
I'm not asking for a multi-party system. I'm asking for political parties that make people who are in the middle feel like they have a place.
You look at parliamentary democracies in Europe, in Israel, in a number of other places where they do have parties on the far left, on the far right, parties in the middle, single issue parties,
yeah,
where everyone who wants a home can literally find one. Their politics are just as screwed up as ours are. Their politics are just as divided. And the rhetoric in their elections is not that dissimilar from our rhetoric here. And what ends up happening? They end up building, even with multiple parties, two big coalitions.
Well, you two know where I stand. I actually think Joe Biden's politics make him the home for that group of people, but that he hasn't really articulated that fact well. But we don't have time to dive into that. But we will, I'm sure, many times this year. But for now, we're going to take a break. And we're going to come back to talk about Title IX and athletics and transgender athletes here on Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Greene. Sarah Isger and Mo Alethi are here with me. Ahead of the November presidential election, here on the show, we're examining stories in all 50 states. And today, it's the state of Connecticut. Four women who ran high school track there went to court to argue that they were at a competitive disadvantage because they had to compete against transgender women. One of the athletes, Chelsea Miller, said she lost more than 20 races in high school because the state allowed transgender athletes to compete. This case was originally dismissed in 2021, but then last month a federal appeals court revived it, and the four women will be able to carry on seeking monetary damages and adjustments to their athletic records. This comes just as President Biden and his administration have been struggling to finalize changes to how the government enforces Title IX. This is the landmark civil rights law that prohibits sex-based discrimination in federally funded schools. Last year, the president proposed a middle ground approach that would make it illegal for schools to ban transgender athletes from competing in certain sports. But schools could deal with individual situations, case by case, and take into account things like student safety and also competitive advantage. So this is a conversation that is happening all over the country in an election year. And joining us to talk about it is our guest today, Kim Jones. She's the co-founder of an organization called the Independent Council on Women's Sports. And Kim, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And just so our listeners understand where you're coming from, I mean, you and your organization have some pretty strong views on this issue. So just remind us where you stand.
Sure. I mean, it's pretty fundamental. We believe that women should never face sex-based discrimination in sports. And that means that women should have access to fair competition and safe sports at every level and every age. And this necessitates having a female category to celebrate the accomplishments of women in society.
And you say having a female category, that to you should not include students who were assigned sex as male at birth but are transgender women. They should not be included in sports.
Yeah, it just patently men can never become women. There is no ability for humans to change sex. It doesn't exist in science, in nature, in whatever. So if you are born male, you will have a male experience. You will have a male body. And if you're born female, you will have a female experience and you will have a female body.
And obviously that's something that a lot of people, as you know better than anyone, disagree with you on and would fight you hard on. But I guess I wonder, can you remind me why this is so personal to you and how you became so passionate and involved in this, because your daughter competed in sports and had experiences that shaped where you are here.
Sure. Not just my daughter. So my history is being a female athlete. Sports have been my entire life. I played tennis, played up through the professional ranks, was an All-American at Stanford and represented the United States at the World University Games. My children chose swimming as their sport. My daughter dedicated her life to that and then spent the entirety of the collegiate swim year 2020-2021 competing against Leah Thomas head to head. And it was incredibly demeaning. Women being told that they need to measure up to male development in a male body is one of the most regressive things I've seen in my life. And it was life-changing to hear that a female body was not worthy of fair competition, of a voice in sports, and was necessarily used to promote and affirm male desires. It was horrible to watch what happened to the confidence and self-esteem of all of the girls, my daughter and her peers. And it was just a life-changing watershed moment to recognize that this is where we are in society, that women are simply tools. And that's an unacceptable world for me to leave behind for my granddaughters.
And let me ask you, I mean, so President Biden has tried to delve into this question and seems to want to regulate Title IX in a way that would honor Leah Thomas's rights as a transgender woman competing in swimming, and also make room for, you know, people like your daughter if there is a competitive disadvantage, if safety is a question. I mean, the president trying to use Title IX to protect rights of everyone as best he can. Do you make room for kind of a middle road proposal like we've seen from the president, or at least the hints that we've gotten from the Biden White House so far?
No, it's not a middle road. It turns Title IX into a weapon to be used against women instead of the only legal protection we have in the United States that recognizes women shouldn't have to face sex-based discrimination. You can't remove the definition of sex and understanding what a female is and still protect her. It's an impossible situation. And this idea that that the Biden administration said, oh, for fairness and safety, they did no such thing. They did not define what fairness is. They did not define what safety is.
If you were sitting down with another mom, let's say, trying mm-hmm. to kind of, you know, grapple with this, and this is a mom who's, you know, whose daughter was assigned male sex at birth, but is a transgender woman and has been training in swimming or in track for years and pouring her heart into the sport. And she is at the table, you know, saying that I want my daughter to be able to compete in a fair way and be protected under the law. You know, even if you have a lot of disagreement, like how would that conversation go?
I agree with that mother. I 100% agree with that mother. And I think it's a misnomer to say that. So I have a strong and profound belief that sports need to be accessible to everyone. Inclusion in sports is the premise of the women's category. It's how we include women in sports. Creating categories is how we have inclusion. So without sports categories, men ages 18 to 35 dominate sports at every level. High school, national, international, collegiate, professional, you name it. We create a category for participants based on age to allow masters athletes to compete, understand what it is to achieve excellence, to have victory, to participate on a team. We do the same thing for our youth. And we do the same thing for those in certain sports with a weight category to allow in boxing or in rowing, to allow participants who are not as big or are huge to have a separation and a chance to show their excellence in achievement in a sport. We do the same thing for Paralympians, for those that are born with disables or lose a limb, born with disabilities or lose a limb. And the way we include 51% of the world's population is to have a sex-based distinction for female athletes. The changing, the injecting of hormones or the idea of a personal self-perception as overriding the physical and biological attributes that necessitate those different categories is never done in any instance, except in this case where the Biden administration is arguing that women should have to step aside and overlook the reason these categories exist.
I just want to ask one question about the Connecticut case. One of the things that interested me is one of the judges noted that the four former high school track stars in Connecticut who brought this case, you know, are now in college and are doing quite well, which suggested to me that you know, that's the judge weighing in on this question of is there competitive disadvantage or not, which probably, you know, if Biden, you know, sort of regulates Title IX the way he's proposing, we're going to be seeing a lot of those kinds of questions coming up in court. You seem to be saying that that's besides the point to you. I'm hearing you say, like, it doesn't matter the results, the competitive disadvantage. It's the experience fundamentally that you find as something you can't accept.
Results matter. Women, absolutely, the results matter. Women deserve to be able to, I mean, but fundamentally, like, sports are about fairness. I mean, and it is the one place in life where it is supposed to be objective. We have huge groups and organizations within sports crafting rules that try to make sure sports are fair and safe. And so the integrity of competition is built on this premise across men and women's sports and any other category. So if you tell women that in the only place in life where there is supposed to be objective truth for fairness, that they are not deemed worthy of it simply by the nature of being born female, then what hope do women have in the rest of their lives in the places where sex discrimination is less visible than it is out on a playing field? It is misogynistic at its core to assert that women must measure up to a male standard.
Kim Jones is co-founder of the Independent Council on Women's Sports. Kim, thank you for coming on and talking to us about this.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I'm really curious to hear what you both think. This is a tough one, as we've seen from President Biden's administration getting comments from around the country on this question and taking a lot of time to figure out how to handle it. I think we just heard one reason why.
I think she explained the policy issue and what's at stake really well, and I'm sure Mo has thoughts on that and disagrees in parts of what she said. But I find the politics of this incredibly fascinating, because the left used to be the defender of Title IX, and it was the right who was constantly saying that Title IX was kind of this, you know, statutory abomination. And that we shouldn't be spending all this money on women's sports. And we've seen a total flip on this, right? The left has by and large abandoned Title IX as being, female centric. And it's the right saying, no, we need female sports. I find it incredibly frustrating in some ways, because to your point, David, about the middle ground on any number of other things, for me, where are feminists supposed to go now? Because if you are a feminist, meaning women, you're born a woman, you have a experience, as she said, in utero from all the time of being a woman, getting your period at a slumber party, being scared, walking in dark alleys, having your mother tell you, let him shoot you in the parking lot, don't ever get in the car because what's going to happen is going to be way worse. I mean, these are one of many, many experiences that women have. And to not have a political movement that we've had for 150 years strongly in this country, and for hundreds and hundreds of years before that, a political party and a political movement dedicated to that is pretty disheartening to me, that has been caught up in our culture wars and now lost, where there's really not feminists qua feminists anymore.
Mo?
I get why she was clearly very passionate about this issue. And I get it, because there is a lot of passion on both sides of this issue. And it's why it is such a difficult one for so many policymakers to deal with in good faith. I don't think a lot of people are dealing with it in good faith, though. And I do think that a part of it is because this has become such an easy focal point in the culture wars. It's become such an easy way for a lot of folks on in right-wing media and the anti-LGBTQ movement to help galvanize broader support where they usually don't get it. But I don't think the information that they're sharing is always good. And I think there's just a couple of things I would want to pick up on. One, and David, I'm glad you brought up the point at the end about the competitive advantage that her side is so worried about, because the data does not seem to support that trans women have any sort of competitive advantage. Number two, and this gets to sort of, I think, what you were talking about with the Biden administration's policy. The Biden administration's policy says there should not be any blanket bans, period. And then it goes on to point out, as you mentioned, David, that when it comes to issues of safety and fairness, that states can look at it, school districts can look at it. From everything I have seen, there seems to be sort of a demarcation line on this issue. And that is the age of puberty. That prepubescent children, there are very few physical differences when it comes to their competitiveness. You go to any grade school, you'll see boys and girls running around on the same soccer field doing just as well. At the point of puberty, the bodies begin to develop very, very differently. If you were talking about a high school student who's already hit puberty, who comes out as trans one day and expects to compete in sports a week later, I think the Biden administration's rule would give schools the ability to say no. But if you've got a student or a young person who has gone through a year of hormone therapy or was taking puberty blockers before they hit puberty, that's a different scientific and biological calculation. And the Biden administration's rule gives schools the ability to look at those types of issues in making the determination. Hey, look, his rule frustrated people on the right.
And the
clearly
left.
Who wanted an all right ban, but it frustrated a lot of people on the left who didn't, appreciate that level of nuance. To your earlier question about where do people in the middle live, I think that's a place that sort of addresses a lot of concerns, gives schools the flexibility, but does protect the rights of these trans students.
But Sarah, can I just, and I wanted to, but before we go, I wanted to bring up this question that you raised in the very beginning when we started talking. Like when you were saying that you can't get how people on the left who were the most passionate fighters for women's rights and for Title IX, how they could be where they are today. Like, to me, they're there today because they believe that they are fighting for transgender women in the same way that they've been fighting for women for years. And that is a continuation of the movement that they have so fervently believed in since they started, fighting for Title IX.
And I guess I find that offensive. I find you saying that is offensive.
Tell me why.
Because A, there's plenty of women out there who are saying that this isn't right and that you are gutting women's ability just to then favor men who were born men. Like, that's offensive to say that we're the same. We're not. I'm not the same as them. If I suddenly said that I've had the same experience as a trans person, and therefore, for instance, when we're talking about diversity in corporate boards or whatever, and they say, well, we've got a trans woman, and I say, well, I'm also a trans woman, like I'm the exact same. Like, we don't think that. There's a reason you don't think that. You think I'm different than a trans woman. Well, I think I'm different than a trans woman too. So to say that somehow feminism is just now the exact same thing, it's just now for trans women instead of other women, that's offensive. Of course, feminism should, can, must exist to represent women still. And that there should also be fights for trans women, for them to be involved in sports, involved, in other places where they feel discriminated against. But to lump us all together, frankly, I don't think it's even remotely acceptable.
I am happy to leave that there with Sarah's having the last word, unless you have anything else you want to say, Mo. Okay, but now it is time for our left, right, and center rants and raves. Sarah, you want to kick us off?
Well, I would just like to note that after 20 years out in Iowa and New Hampshire and campaigns and, 2 a.m., you get to the hotel, and 4 a.m., you've got to wake up for morning TV hits, I never drank caffeine. I like, relying on my own energy. And I have an addictive personality, so no cigarettes, no caffeine, nothing like that. But boy, they don't tell you that second kid. So despite all of those things that I have done in my life without caffeine, second kid did it for me. So this is a rave for caffeine. I'm in. I'm part of your club. I get it. Thank you, caffeine.
I'm holding my coffee cup up so you can see it. All right. I don't know if this is a rant or a rave, but I'm going to stay on my romanticizing about our politics moment getting into 24. It's more of a buckle up. Like, I mean, every presidential election we, in the media talk about trying to avoid just the horse race and to cover things in a more thoughtful, nuanced way. And I want to say that a show like today is the best of what I feel like we can do in a year like 2024. Just deeper, more interesting, fundamental questions about who we are, and a space where we can actually provoke each other to an extent and be honest about our reactions. And I pray that we can show all of you out there that you can have versions of this kind of conversation as a way to grapple with this moment and what I'm sure is going to be a year full of a lot of loud, angry rhetoric. So I will leave it there. And thank you to Mo and Sarah, as always. And thank you, of course, for the team that works tirelessly every week to put the show together. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. And Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. And we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. Thanks for being here. And come back next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at KCRW.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
From PRX.